Thanks, Lane. So Friday, I think it was Friday, I was driving back from work, and I switched to radio on, Radio 2 if anyone's interested. I'm very middle of the road now. Usually I have the radio on, but actually I was thinking a bit about this sermon and what I was going to say and stuff like that. And I turned the radio on, and imagine my surprise when I hear this gravelly voice singing, and I'm not going to sing, but this is what I heard. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, "All men will be sailors until the sea shall free them." And that, apparently, is a song called Suzanne by this man, Leonard Cohen. I didn't know that. It's probably a really well-known song. And I don't really understand the song, I'm afraid. But it is an obvious reference to Jesus walking on the water. I don't think it actually helps us understand the passage that much. But it's a reference to Jesus walking on the water. And Jesus walking on the water is also referenced in nature. This here is a picture of the Jesus lizard. And this is a tiny little lizard that can run and skip across the pond. It walks on water. And I say all this because actually, walking on water, a man walking on water, it's a stupendous event. People take notice whether they're Christian or not. They put verses in their songs about it. They name lizards after it. It's incredible. We are supposed to marvel at it. But it's more than just a stupendous event. A man walking on water has meaning. And it's quite simple, really. This shows us that Jesus is the Son of God. But what does that title, Son of God, mean? In what ways does knowing, believing that Jesus is the Son of God help us to trust him, to follow him, and worship him? And we're going to try and explore that this morning. The first point is quite straightforward. Just believe that Jesus is the Son of God. So as we saw in the little cartoon earlier on, Jesus has just finished feeding the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And he sends the crowd home, and he also sends his disciples into a boat on their own to go to the other side of the lake. And he's left on his own, and he spends that evening and that night, actually, in prayer. And he's on a mountainside, and he looks out from the mountainside, and he can see that the wind is against the boat, and it's struggling against the waves. And then sometime between 3 and 6 a.m., we're told, verse 25, that Jesus went out to them. Now, how did he do this? Well, he didn't hire a boat, which is probably what I'd do, given my rowing ability. He didn't pilot a boat himself. He didn't swim. He went out to them, walking on the lake. Bang, it's just there, very matter of fact. He went out to them, walking on the lake. And I think there's a few things we should note if we really want to appreciate this miracle in all its glory. So the first thing is that there's a lot of wind and waves about. Jesus is walking on the water. And I think before in my mind's eye, I'd always imagined it was quite calm and serene. It is anything but calm and serene. Quite the opposite, in fact. You know, it talks about the waves kind of bashing the boat and there's the wind up. It's not a calm night. And Jesus is walking on the water. The disciples in the boat, they're not like where Elaine's sitting from the shore. They're not like a few metres away. It's not like you could jump to them. Jesus could jump to them. They're, we're told, a considerable distance away from the shore. That probably means at least a kilometre or two, I think. And this is a miracle that's unprecedented in biblical history. The nearest thing, I think, is in many ways, is Elisha making an axe head float. But no king or prophet walked on top of the water. Moses and the Israelites walked through the Red Sea, but that was a sea that had been parted. They were walking on the seabed on ground. They didn't walk on top of the water. And it's not just unprecedented in biblical history, but in human history, no one else has done this or will do it. The other thing we need to appreciate that, and this may be stating the blindingly obvious, but I think it's worth saying, the essential quality of water, I believe, is that it's a liquid. And if you try to walk on it, you sink. And please feel free to try it at home if you don't believe me, or get one of your children to if you've got kids, and that could be quite entertaining. But to walk on water is to rip up fundamental laws of nature. It probably gives a physicist just a headache thinking about it. Jesus' power and authority is such that all the elements and molecules, the very laws of physics themselves, bend themselves to his will. But it's not just Jesus that walks on the water, is it? He enables Peter. Peter's able to walk on the water too, in verse 29, at least for a short time. That's incredible as well. In many ways, it's even more marvellous. And the other thing to say is that walking on the water is not the only miracle that Jesus performs here. After he catches Peter and stops him drowning, they climb up in the boat. And look what happens next in verse 32. The wind died down. That isn't just a throwaway phrase. It's not just a coincidence. We're supposed to be reminded here of Matthew 8, where Jesus calmed the storm with a couple of words. Here the wind again obeys Jesus according to his will. He doesn't have to say anything this time. And what is the disciples' response to this? Well, initially when they see Jesus out on the water, they're terrified, verse 26. They think it's a ghost. Well, come on, we'll focus on Peter's particular response a bit later on. But when Jesus gets in the boat, what do they do? What do they say? They say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And they worship him. Before, in similar circumstances, when Jesus calmed the storm, they said, "Who is this man?" Now they know. Now they say, "Jesus, you are the Son of God." But what did they mean by that? What do we mean by that? Well, let's look at a few Old Testament passages to help us. So Job, chapter 9, verse 8. This is Job describing God. "He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea." In Psalm 93, "The seas have lifted up, O Lord. The seas have lifted up their voice. The seas have lifted up their," I can read it on there, "their pounding waves, mightier than the thunder of the great waters, mightier than the breakers of the sea. The Lord on high is mighty." Or Psalm 107, "Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed." "They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to their desired haven." See, God was, and God is, the God of the storm. He alone has mastery over it. It's a divine power. And those references in the psalm, they're poetic, they're true, but Jesus actually did it. He treaded on the waves. He calmed the storm. He has mastery over the storm. And so we declare Jesus to be the Son of God. Jesus is one person with two natures. He's the human being, the friend of sinners, as Matthew talked about with us last week. He walked as we walk, cried as we cry, felt as we feel. But he's also divine, eternal, infinite, immense, ruler over all creation. And this is who we're worshipping. This is who we've been singing songs to this morning. The title Son of God reminds us of the divine almighty nature of Jesus Christ. Now, in Hebrew languages, when you said son of, you meant of the same type, you meant in the same class. So when you say Son of God, you're saying God or God-like. Now, there's lots more background and lots more things we could say about the Son of God. There are parts of the Bible where Israel is called the Son of God, or where the King of Israel is referred to as the Son of God. But the point is that Jesus fulfilled these by Jesus being the Son of God, because he's the eternal promised messianic king, and through belief in him, all Christians become children of God. The title Son of God also reminds us of his close and special relationship with God, the Father. So in Matthew 11, for instance, a bit earlier on, Jesus talks about that only he really knows the Father, and only he can reveal him to others. But I think in the main, when the disciples here exclaiming, "Jesus, you are the Son of God," they're saying, "You're God." that though he's human, he's one at the same time God. His God nature does not diminish his human nature, and his human nature does not diminish his God nature. He is unique. There is no one else like Jesus. He is the Son of God. And if we want more encouragement or other verses to reflect on, and the Bible is full of them, we could look at Hebrews verses 1 to 4. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. Jesus made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. This is Jesus. He's sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. So we can't, having read all this, thought about all this, seen all this, we can't let Jesus be small in our hearts and in our minds, or in our prayers and in our worship. He's the Son of God, and to be a Christian is to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And remember, this makes it even more brilliant, this is the almighty, powerful Son that stooped low and became human. The Son of God who died for us and sacrificed himself in our place. This is who we're talking about. This is who we're praising and worshipping. And it's precisely because he was the Son of God that death couldn't hold him, and he was resurrected to life and is now ruling in heaven at the Father's side and remains a friend of sinners like you and me. If Jesus was not the Son of God, he could be your friend, but he couldn't save you. If Jesus is not the Son of God, he can't help you today. He can't intercede for you. He can't use his power to help you and change you. But he is. He is the Son of God. And I'm going to see how that makes a difference to our lives, our service as Christians now. But before we do that, I just want to take a reality check. Well, a sort of a reality check. My second point really is that we recognise the fears and doubts that stop us, that stop you trusting, that stop me trusting in the Son of God. Recognise the fear and doubts that stop you trusting in the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God, and he's my Saviour. And as we've seen, there's nothing he cannot do, no area of life or creation that is outside his remit, outside his rule. So why do I get scared then? Why do I doubt when things are hard or not what I expect? Because if Jesus is the Son of God, nothing else should matter in comparison. And I should be able to follow him without doubt or fear, shouldn't I? Let's look again at this story to try and help us understand this. And this is where we're going to try and focus on Peter. Now we're going to go back to verse 28 we're going to come back to why Peter got out of the boat in verse 28. For now, we're just going to skip ahead to verses 29 to 31. So Jesus said it's okay for Peter to come to him. So Peter gets out of the boat and he doesn't sink. He doesn't need to swim. He too walked on the water and he walks towards Jesus. Peter's walking on the water, and presumably he's focused, he's facing, like I'm looking at Mike now, he's walking towards him. I'm not equating you with Jesus, Mike, but it's just like you're in front of me. And the ecstasy and euphoria of those first steps must have been amazing. But it doesn't last. Look what happens in verse 30. When he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Peter's doing well. But then he starts to see the large waves whipped up by the wind. Perhaps he looks back too and sees that the boat now is quite far behind him. The wind's shrieking now and it's surrounding him. He feels the waves buffeting and bouncing off his legs. And he's afraid. And with that fear, he's no longer able to walk on the water. And he starts to sink and presumably might have drowned if Jesus hadn't reached down and rescued him. What went wrong? Why did Peter go so quickly from walking in faith to sinking in fear? And I think Jesus' questioning, yet gentle rebuke to Peter helps us to provide the answer. You of little faith, why did you doubt? It's a really good question. Peter had been in a worse storm than this already and seen Jesus tame it with a couple of words. Why did he doubt? Shouldn't he have remembered what Jesus could do? Why was he afraid? What was it about his faith that was little at that point? It's clear, isn't it, that Peter got into trouble when he started to take more notice of the winds and waves around him than Jesus. When he focused away from Jesus onto his surroundings. That's when he became fearful. That's when he started to doubt. So essentially, Peter was looking more to his situation than to Jesus. He paid most attention, understandably, to what his eyes, ears, and senses were telling him about what the danger he was in. I think Jesus is saying he should have paid more attention by faith to him, to Jesus, who could keep him safe from the danger he was in. And so a lack of faith, and by lack of faith we mean not looking to Jesus, lets in fear. Fear leads to doubt, and doubt can lessen our faith even further. And before you know it, you can actually be in a vicious cycle where you're going round and round, spiralling down and down. And you can easily imagine how actually in a few seconds that happened to Peter. Will he be able to keep going, he thinks? And the doubts increase, the fears grow, and his faith in that particular moment shrinks, and then he's sinking. So what about me? What about you? What are your fears, your doubts? Now, it's unlikely it'll be as dramatic as that. But what are the doubts and fears that creep upon you, that weaken your faith, the circumstances that cause you to take your eyes off Jesus and just seem so overwhelming? The circumstances that you pay more attention to than Jesus himself. That in turn, if you let it, would just eat away at your faith, nibble away at it, letting in more doubt and fear. What are they? It might be an ongoing issue with the doubts and fears that just come at you day after day with it. It could be just a one-off thing that happens where fears and doubt just suddenly come crashing at you unexpected. Let me just suggest a few examples. So this is an example for me. So before Christmas, I did some flyering at Queen's Road Fair. So for a Christmas event. So for those of you who don't know, you go out in when it's really, really cold and you hand out flyers to anyone who'll pass by, which means basically you have to sort of get in their eye line, interrupt them, get their attention, and give them a flyer. Now, I don't know if anyone's ever given out flyers before, but it's a bit of a seesaw of emotions. At least it was for me. You get a few knockbacks, people refusing you, people turning you down, and you feel dispirited, you feel rejected, you feel horrible. But then if you get some positive responses, you feel quite good about yourself, you feel great, yeah, I can do this, this is fantastic. And I experienced both sides of that. And I think what that actually meant was that I was just a slave to the circumstances of giving out flyers and the doubts that assailed me. If I got refused, start to think, oh, I'm not very good at this, I can't do this. Why are we doing this anyway as a church? What's the point of this? I'd be kind of fearful, what's that next person going to say? Will they take one off me? And it was just you know, whatever the next person did, that would affect how I was. And it's pathetic, really. But I think that's something of what was going on in my head and my heart. You know, other examples might be around talking to family, friends, or work colleagues about Jesus, about your faith, inviting them to an event. And we fear what people's opinions of us might be if we steer the conversation to Jesus. We doubt they want to come. They've not come before when we've asked them. So why ask again? We focus on, like, you know, just how anti-Christian our culture seems to be. So why bother? Or, you know, we've tried before, we see no change, so we just stop. We stop praying. We stop trying. or it could be more long-term things, suffering that you or a close friend or family member are going through. It's horrible, it's painful, it's unfair. And so we doubt God's goodness. We doubt his power to change things. You fear for the future and focus on those circumstances and pain. You know, we could go on to others. We could talk about a work situation with a difficult colleague while you're in this job, or, you know, you take on responsibility at church and it starts off well, but as time goes on, the regular commitment just seems harder, more difficult, and people can sometimes be draining, and then you're not sure if what you're doing is working, and you're fearful people are thinking you're doing a rubbish job, all sorts of things. And all of the ones I've said, I could probably at one time or another apply to myself. And the fear and doubt eat away at your faith. Not as quickly as Peter, but they can do. What then is the answer? So how do we live and serve as faithful Christians and deal with those fears and doubts that come? How do we ensure we live by faith and not as slaves to our circumstances, focused only on what's around us, what our senses tell us matter? Well, it's not surprising that we go back to where we started. We follow and worship Jesus, the Son of God. We follow and worship Jesus, the Son of God. So let's go back to a passage to help us understand this. So let's rewind to where Jesus appears in view. The disciples are scared, but Jesus reassures them, saying, "It is I." Now, imagine you're in that boat. Imagine you're one of the disciples. What might you say in response when Jesus says that? I was thinking I might say, is it really you, Jesus? Or, "Jesus, come and get in the boat. You must be freezing." Or, "You're walking on water. What?" To be fair, I don't think it would ever have crossed my mind to say what Peter says. "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." We're so familiar with it, I think we forget to be shocked by it. That's an incredible thing to say. Is Peter speaking from the heart? And it's a great statement of faith, actually. Because at his very core, at that moment, that his reaction is that Peter believes that Jesus can absolutely do this for him. That Jesus, if it is Jesus, can enable him, Peter, to walk on the water. And I don't think Peter's testing Jesus in that sense. He just wants to be with Jesus. He just wants to get close to Jesus. And the fact that Jesus responds, "Come," shows that Jesus, you know, he approves of Peter's suggestion. He says, "Yeah, come on." And as we said, Peter does it. He starts off and he's walking on the water. And how can he do it? Because he's fixed upon the Son of God. And as long as he's fixed upon the Son of God, as long as he's trusting and has faith, he's able to do it. Peter is acting not in his own strength, but in the strength of Jesus, the Son of God. And at that moment, when it's working, his faith is outweighing all the fears and all the doubts. Because he's consumed, he's just set on Jesus. And so Jesus, the Son of God, and his power is bigger than any circumstance, any fear, and any doubt. It's true for Peter then, and it's true for us now. And actually, Peter's action reveals something fundamental about being a disciple of Jesus, which I found really helpfully put in one of the commentaries I read. A real disciple doesn't just repeat the teachings of their master, paraphrasing. They don't just say what your master says. A real disciple follows in your master's footsteps, as Peter did here. A disciple of Jesus, a Christian, if you're a Christian here today, like you and me, we're to be people of action. We are to imitate Jesus in thought, in word, and in deed. So by faith in the Son of God, by his strength and his power, that's how we're to go on living our lives and serving as faithful Christians. So next time I help giving out flyers, how might that change? Well, actually, before I even get to Queen's Road, before I even give out a single flyer, I'm going to just take a few minutes to set my mind right, to see the circumstances and things as they really are, not as they may feel when I'm there. I'm going to take a few minutes to remind myself that I'm serving the Son of God in what I'm doing. You know, Jesus wants people to know about him, so handing out flyers to events where we tell people about Jesus wants that. I remind myself that his divine power is working through me, will work, that he's in charge and he will help me. I remind myself maybe of this passage or that passage in Hebrews. So that my eye of faith is filled with the Son of God. Now I'll still get some knockbacks. Of course I will. It won't necessarily change how good I am at giving out flyers. But hopefully, rather than dwelling on them and letting them determine how I then feel and letting the fears and doubts take hold, I'll again remind myself of these truths. That I'm serving the Son of God. He isn't affected by a few knockbacks. He's King of the world. He can change people's hearts. His saving purposes will not be beaten. I'm not just handing out some flyers. Who am I doing it for? And knowing I'm doing it for the Son of God, I can be absolutely confident that he's with me. I can send quick prayers out knowing that he hears me. I can encourage others and be encouraged because we have God on our side. And if it still starts to get really pear-shaped, if I get really down and full of doubts, I can still, like Peter, say, Lord, save me. That's okay. That's a statement of faith too. And Jesus in his faith will pick me up and help me go again some other time in some other way. And I can know that such testing, even when I fail like that, refines my faith. Helps me to trust Jesus even more. And even in these sort of chronic, long-term situations, it's possible to be faithful, to be hopeful. And the question is always, it always comes back to, do we focus more on our circumstances and on Jesus, Son of God? Do we let ourselves, do we make ourselves turn to him and worship him, dwell on who he is as the Son of God to help us? And if you're in a situation like that, try and find a few minutes each day just to strengthen your faith muscles with regard to seeing and worshipping Jesus as the Son of God. Reflect on this passage or others where we see Jesus do similar miracles, the transfiguration, the resurrection, the cross, Jesus sitting at the Father's side. Use the verses from Hebrews, a daily meditation. What I'm going to do actually is, I read this book a few years ago, Through the Looking Glass. It's a great book for kind of seeing Jesus. And I'm just going to read a short little passage, not even a chapter, every day. You know, I've got 2 minutes to do that. Even if I have to go and hide in the toilet, I can do that. So that's one thing I'm going to do. Just so I can remind myself of Jesus, who he really is. He's bigger and worthy of our worship. It's just that sometimes we don't see it or see it as often as we should. So let's just finish off by returning to the thought that a disciple, a Christian, we're to be people of action, we're to imitate Jesus in thought, word, and deed, we're to follow him by faith in the Son of God and in his strength. That is how we're to go about living our lives and serving him. And that's true for us as a church. So as leaders at Avenue Community Church, we've been saying off and on now that we want Avenue Community Church to grow. Hopefully you've heard us say that at the front from time to time, and we've said it in family meetings as well. And we really mean it. We want to see every Christian here grow in the faith and knowledge of Jesus Christ. And we want to see Avenue Community Church grow in numbers as men, women, and children become Christians and put their faith in him. Through the actions of our church, through God working through our church, through God working through you, through the power of Jesus, but using us. God working through us to will and to act according to his purposes. And we should trust and we should have faith in Jesus, the Son of God, that he will do that, that he'll enable us to grow, that his power will work through us as we strive to grow for his glory and take steps out in faith. Now, we might have all sorts of doubts and fears about that. But there's even just a few simple ways. It doesn't have to be anything spectacular, that any one of us in this room can be part of helping our church to grow. So, Richard said earlier, we've got a Christianity Explored group starting up. Have you invited your friend along? Have faith in the Son of God. Don't let your doubts about whether they will come or not, or what they might think of you, don't let that reality shape whether they will come or not. Or we've got the stories of Jesus in a week. You know, if someone's a Tigers fan, or you know someone who's a Tigers fan, it's an easy invite, isn't it? Or are you regularly sharing with your home group non-Christian friends to pray for? And is your home group regularly praying for them? Or have you given up praying? Do you doubt prayer will be answered because it's just been so long and there's been no change? See no change in that person. Why bother? Don't let that determine your reality. The Son of God has power to answer prayer. Don't doubt he will answer. Or let's imagine this morning when we have coffee and donuts in a moment. You're chomping on your donut, you're drinking your coffee. You happen to be on your own. You see a new person standing on their own. No one else is talking to them. In fact, you're the nearest person to them. Maybe you should go and speak to them. Except, well, you don't normally do that sort of thing, and you might say the wrong thing, and they look really cool, and I'm not really cool. And what happens if the conversation dries up, or if I say the wrong thing, and oh, actually, maybe they want to be on their own, and oh, look, there's my friend over there. No, no. Go and talk to them, because as a Christian, the power of the Son of God is working through you. He wants to work his power through you. He wants that person to be welcomed. If Jesus enabled Peter to walk on water, he can enable your fumbling words to warmly welcome someone to a church family, even if you find that really awkward. So if in God's strength and power we commit to following Jesus, the Son of God, by faith and worship him and see him as he truly is, then I'm sure we will grow as a church. Maybe only in faith, maybe in numbers as well. We leave that to God, but I trust we will grow. So don't let your doubts and fears and surrounding circumstances paralyze you. See Jesus, the Son of God, as he really is, and live by faith in him day by day. It doesn't have to be spectacular, it just needs to be faithful.